Ship of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakas.
Good morning. This is Fotis. Greenwich, Fotis Baliakas from Greenwich. Good morning, everyone. This is my second radio broadcast. It comes to you regularly every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. So I hope you have your Americano coffee made and are eager to listen. Today's subject is energy, and more specifically, the geopolitics of energy. Just to remind you how energy interrelates to geopolitics, geostrategy, geoeconomics, the sovereign state's statecraft, that is the tools of conducting and projecting domestic and foreign policy, includes, among many other things, economy, diplomacy, military, energy, technology, finance, legal, human, capital, information, intelligence, media, culture, religion, or secularism. So energy is one that permeates almost everything. Energy is the capacity to do work. It exists in many forms. It is neither generated nor lost. It's simply changing forms. So let us examine a couple of examples so you can see how it plays in our lives, in our daily lives, and how it projects to much bigger issues around the world. So let's say potential energy. It's associated usually with gravity. By elevating a body of mass, say, above sea level, that which has mass and then falls has stored in it potential energy, like the snow that will melt from the high mountains or the water running off the Niagara Falls, which more particularly is called hydropower, from the Greek word hydro, either, nero, the water, and the power. So the water, as it falls, gains kinetic energy, another Greek word, kinetic, kinesi, motion, like a river flow from higher elevation to lower elevation. And then it could hit the paddles of a wheel connected to a shaft in the old times, which in turn turn a mechanical shaft and create energy, or they can spin a turbine to convert into electricity. That's hydroelectric energy. But we started with elevated body of water, which ended up charging an iPhone, and that's where we're going to end up. The electricity that is generated from hydroelectric power cannot be exported. It's very local, or the actual hydroelectric power cannot be exported. So it's mostly for domestic sources of energy, not significant factors in geopolitics. So I'm warming up to the next subject. Among other energies that we have, like the human body uses chemical energy, which is stored in foods, in caloric content. A calorie is a measure of energy required to heat a certain volume of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit, for example, so that you have an idea what the calories are that we consume. That chemical energy is released and produces thermal energy that keeps us warm. Thermal, that's another Greek word. It keeps our core temperature between 98 and 100 degrees. And, you know, a good example of that energy is Lance Armstrong, the bike racer. If not doped or could not, or if he was not doped, he could bike so hard to produce enough electrical energy to power a domestic appliance. So electrical energy is more prevalent in our daily lives and mistakenly is considered to be the cleanest form. It is clean when it's consumed, but not when converted from other forms of energy. So the EV owners, the newest cars in the market, the Teslas, etc., the superchargers are not powered by clean energy. 85% of that energy that's converted to electricity comes in from other mostly fossil fuels, that pollute somewhere else, you know, maybe Ohio or West Virginia, but not here. So you just don't see it. The reason, though, that electric energy is popular, it's because the appliances and the applications that we have are very efficient. Think of cars, motors, lighting, computer devices, and such. So sources of chemical energy is where we depend mostly now to produce our energy. And fossil fuels or hydrocarbons, based on the composition of hydrogen and carbon molecules, are deposits on the Earth's crust. These materials, we have discovered, have inherent form of chemical energy, which may be released with the application of heat, ignition, or addition of oxygen or combustion, or compression of a mixture of the of chemical with the air. So we have applied technology to these raw materials to convert them to energy. So if you're familiar with the Alfred Nobel invention of the dynamite in 1960, it was to replace black powder, which was used in cannon fire. It was to project, to propel heavy solid projectiles. Well, the chemical composition of this liquid material, which when ignited by a fuse expands in volume millions of times from its original size. So that explosion creates work that can move mountains. And that's how it was used, reclaiming the West territories from Mississippi to California. So the most known use of chemical energy transformation in daily lives are engines, our transportation engines, that what we call the internal combustion engines, where we manage to control the explosion of the air fuel mixture or harness the vast volume displaced. We also find it in jet engines, helicopters, battle tanks, or diesel and gasoline engines for commercial trucks, buses, cars, ships, trains. Or we use liquid hydrogen for booster rockets, ICBM, or hypersonic and low-flying cruise missiles. So the explosion of these chemical mixtures under controlled conditions in a combustion chamber expands the pre-ignition air to 1,000 times its original volume, or maybe millions of times, and applies the resulting air pressure on a piston or turbine blade, which attached to a rotating craft or a crankshaft. It turns a motor and converts this chemical ignition into mechanical energy and then into electrical energy, which we use mostly. So I just described the critical applications to run our economy and our military. I don't need to say more about the importance of energy, especially the hydrocarbon energy that is available right now. But there are other forms as well. Now we will examine the nuclear energy. The famous Manhattan Project, run secretly concurrently with World War II in the U.S., where the American and European scientists harnessed the energy released from atoms when forced to break up. The fission of atoms caused the release of a magnitude of energy that was unimaginable. The material created such a heat generation and air displacement that it was deemed to be the most effective dynamite, a bomb, an instrument of war, and a statecraft for the U.S. government then that could end the war. Well, eventually other countries got that as well. 1949, the Russians kind of stole the secret, and eventually there was proliferation of that. Well, the stigma of the nuclear weapon technology was stuck with this excellent form of energy conversion. The fission, unfortunately, produces a byproduct of nuclear waste, which is a radioactive material that remains active for over 100 years. It's called a half-life, and need to be handled properly and secured. It is, though, a very little-known fact that only about 250 people have died from accidents from accidental release of radiation from civilian use of the technology, including the most recent one in 1988 in Chernobyl in the Ukraine. So the death statistic is minuscule to, say, deaths from homicides in Chicago every year. Yet, it is viewed with extreme polarization. I believe, and you will hear me later, that this is about to change and will become and will come back to the nuclear energy production later with comments about fusion and quantum physics.
Can I jump in quickly? I just happened to be watching a documentary the other day about thorium being used for fission production. And apparently it was tried early on, but they had a problem with containing the process because it apparently ate away at the metal that they use to contain the combustion, and they couldn't get around that. But if they do use thorium, it creates a great deal less waste, and I think they said a 15% better energy production, more efficient. So apparently the Indians, East Indians, are looking at doing this, and the Chinese are also have a couple of test thorium plants that they're working on. This may be what's going to happen.
I'm sure that the technology either is shared or started in the United States, but our aversion to nuclear energy lets others get ahead of us.
Yes.
And it will be something that will come back, and it will be something that will help us in the United States to secure our energy sources. So I will later on, I will read from my papers that I wrote while I was at Columbia about the how the industry was developed and how we will achieve security, energy security, and we can supply our own demand so we can become independent from outside sources. And therefore, no leverage can be used against us in this form. So the energy from the ancient times was a source of power. Just think about the human capital. The size of the army provided the energy, the power to work and accomplish all these physical feats. The Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Vikings, all these navies relied on human power by rowing to propel the boats. The wind later harnessed on ships and boats, ineffectively, that is, at the beginning, because the boats lacked the hydrodynamic appendages to apply the force of wind to the water. Animals were used to do the same heavy lifting, but they needed as much care as the humans, and the energy source was the crops from the earth. The great sailing ships plied the oceans for thousands of years. So we all know how unreliable winds are. The ones who are sailors here in Greenwich know that very well. But the trade winds were discovered by experience and became reliable enough to use them to circumnavigate the earth and to develop trade routes. So harnessing the free energy of the wind gave rise to transportation, trade, and the development of economies. Sailing was not taught at a trade school, but it was learned with years of apprenticeship and experience on ships. A tradition was established of maritime nations like in Britain, Scotland, Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal. A non-maritime nation or state was at a major disadvantage in shipbuilding technology and raw materials were not to be found in every place in the world. So wood became a source of power. The British had established an empire based on free energy, on that wind, but not as fast or reliable. But with the advent of the steam engine in the Industrial Revolution, a new source of energy was used that was available before, but only to heat homes and warm the humans. Now this form of carbon-based chemical, a byproduct of buried dead forest over millions of years decomposed under pressure in the earth, this source, coal, became the new fuel that heated water from liquid to a superheated steam, which then harnessed and channeled properly, expanded from high pressure, and displaced the piston connected to a rotating crankshaft in a steam engine. Simple stuff. This heavy engine was used in the railroads, factories, ships, which displaced the sailing or sails from the ships and the use of animals and human power in land. This new fuel was required to be available around the world so that production in factories can be powered everywhere. The British Royal Fleet needed the fuel around the world to replenish its fuel and stay out at sea longer. So a search around the world ensued to locate deposits. Europe was fortunate to have unending deposits underneath them, which powered the Industrial Revolution and made empires of the states that had the fuel, and the technology to use it, of course, such as Britain, the U.S., and Germany. This fuel source, though, was very dirty to handle, took a lot of space, produced a lot of black smoke, and sometimes unexpectedly exploded when stored in closed areas like the hulls of ships. So sailing ships and later steamships hunted whales for their fat and oil, which was used to light lamps for lightning at night. The ancient world near the Mediterranean Sea used olive oil as a fuel for lighting. Things changed dramatically, though, when here in the United States, Colonel Edwin Drake struck oil in northwestern Pennsylvania in 1859. And that started the new phase of the oil industry with the kerosene, which replaced any fuel for lighting. So John Rockefeller started the Standard Oil with 39 other affiliate companies to create the trust in the late 1800s and controlled 90% of the kerosene and lubricant market, which not only was used for as a initial fuel, lighting lamps, and lubrication of any kind of engine. It was a switch from the natural fats to oils out of the earth. But most importantly, the next discovery here again in the United States in 1901 in East Texas, it's called the Spindletop Discovery, is what changed the world as we know it today. The new mode of transportation, the automobile and later the airplane, started with internal combustion engines. These inventions needed fuel, that oil-derived fuel that was refined from crude oil to something that can be combusted easier, had a huge potential to change the way of life for the masses and transform economies. Petroleum will be used as a major fuel for the inventions and replace the engines and ships and trains that previously ran on coal. So the 20th and now the 21st century, oil and recently natural gas are the world's most important sources of energy. Oil was considered the global fuel because it can be transported. So we have these huge ships that ply the oceans, take from the Middle East, take oil and or Russia and or the U.S., and they cruise across the world. The natural gas, though, was not a global fuel until recently, where we were able to produce and construct pipelines that can be rested on the seabed, very deep seabed, by the way. See, and also the use of liquefied natural gas, where we take the natural gas, chill it to very low temperature, liquefies it, then you can put it on ships and transport it around the world. So the energy that we have, this oil and gas industry, is one of the largest, most complex, and most important global industries. The industry touches everyone's life. Yeah, transportation, heating, electricity. We make roadways, asphalt, lubricants, petrochemical products, the plastics, everything. The industry impacts national security, of course, geopolitics, and international conflicts. Many wars have started because of the location or ownership or claim ownership of the fuels. The price of crude oil and natural gas are probably the most closely watched commodities in the globe. We have the Brent, which is based in Europe, in northern Europe. We have the WTI, the West Texas Intermediate, which is a U.S. version. And now recently we have more versions of these crude benchmarks in the Middle East, like Qatar. Russia has been trying to establish its own Urals version of it, but has been unsuccessful. And that is a source of power by itself to have a benchmark. So, you know, the industry has seen many events. You know, the the oil, the growth oil and gas production in the United States has gone up and down. We have used political power to sanction Russia. We have used it to improve international relations with Iran or otherwise back in the days of the Shah, and then it reversed. But the continued technological advances, it's very critical. In 2014, we came up with the fracking of strata of Earth underneath us that we were not able to penetrate with the known technology that we had to reach out to deeper levels of deposits. But with this hydraulic fracturing, we inject fluids onto the Earth to break formations of stone so that we can release the access and get to that reservoir. It changed the world. It every year we knew that we were talking about from the 1950s on that there will be a peak of oil. This U.S. Geological Survey's many years, at some point we'll run out of oil, and we have not. Every major company is measured on the amount of deposit it has, how much it produces and sells, and then how much it finds to replenish its stock. So technology helped us in two ways. First, to find more oil, and second, to use it more efficiently. Therefore, the longevity of this fuel as a standard of energy has remained. And it looks like, in my view, it will remain for the foreseeable future, 25 to 30 years. So there are many theories about the peak oil, and it's still not proven that we will run out, but we may. I will go back now to explain how this oil business works around the world, and there are two major players. Here in the United States, the government does not own oil, other than its strategic petroleum oil, which is a form of safety net for 90 days use. Because of the shocks that we had absorbed in the 1970s, the Western civilizations, the Western countries came together and said, we can't stand being forced into positions where we don't have energy to use. So they all agreed to create this petroleum reservoir that here in the United States, I think we're about 300 million barrels. At some point, it was good enough for 90 days, but I'm not sure if that's the current burn rate today. I will explain that some of the countries now that use this, they have the energy, they have the reserves, and they produce it. It gives them standing power. It gives them geopolitical power. The United States, I mean, we are among the top producers of oil and gas. We produce more than 10 million, maybe 11 to 13 million at a peak, million barrels a day. We burn a lot, but we are among the producers, and we export. The Obama administration allowed the export of the fuel, and that made the United States one of the major players. We all know Saudi Arabia, obviously. It's maybe the second now producer of oil. Russia, the most recent example of a geostrategic maneuver to corner the Europeans, especially the Germans, that they were being supplied 40% of gas and 30% of liquid oil from Russia. And then during this war that is happening in Ukraine, the Europeans decided to cut off that source. Well, they had to replace it with something other than lowering their thermostat. It's good and efficient, but that's not a long-term solution. So this countries that have the power to of demand, meaning that you have the demand and they provide it and they can stop providing it. And back in 2016, the Europeans froze again because a spat between Russia and Ukraine stopped the flow of gas in the middle of the winter. And they all were awakened by the fact that they're not securing their energy. So it became a political tool. Other countries like Canada, China, the UAE, Iran, Kuwait, Iraq, Mexico, Venezuela, Nigeria, Brazil, Qatar, Norway, Angola, Kazakhstan, Algeria, Colombia, Oman. We produce over 100 million barrels a day, and we consume that. So there are two ways. There are countries that they own their own national oil companies, and countries like the United States have private and public companies that they own the oil. And these are called the national oil companies and the independent oil companies. So ExxonMobil, which was the result of the Rockefeller empire, is an example of the independence. And the national oil companies is example of Saudi Arabia. So they coexist, and they compete, but they produce and they sell oil in the global markets according to the different standards that we have. And in the 1960s, the OPEC, which is a cartel of certain countries, which is called the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, represented many different countries that produced the oil, and it was to control prices and to control the supply to the market and return money to their investors. So it was to maintain discipline. But as a cartel, obviously, they cared more about them than the rest of the world that consumed it. So the price of oil has gone to $140 that I remember. That's the crude oil, which resulted in $5 to $6 gasoline price here in the pump, which is a shock to any economy, any industry. So those dynamics play continuously. The 1973-74 embargo after the Middle Eastern war in Israel, the Seven-Day War, and prior to that, the 1967 Seven-Day War, the stoppage of supply of oil to the regular market gave a shock, which was good and bad. The bad thing was immediate reaction that there wasn't enough oil to go around, and it was a shock to every economy and sent everyone to a recession. England in the 1970s, late 70s, was teetering with bankruptcy. But what that caused is R&D, research and development. So the Alaska Pudhoe Bay area was discovered or developed because of that embargo. So from the 1980s on, the United States had a major supply of its own. England, Scotland, Norway in the North Sea discovered the North fields that to this day produce the Brent that is a major source of oil for around the world. So the Arab embargo was a double-edged sword for the ones who caused it, but it helped us to regain our energy independence. So the integrated oil companies and national oil companies coexist in a dynamic and geopolitically charged environment. They support each other in a delicate balance of providing each other with the best in breed. And they have the majority of reserves and the production capability. Technology is a major, major factor in this. So the national oil companies strive to excel in technology that make the most expensive upstream operation possible and make the downstream operation efficient. So the upstream is the exploration, and the downstream is the refinement to usable fuels. At the beginning of the 20th century, the NICs, the national companies, were the major players worldwide. But the decolonization and nationalization of assets reversed the tables. Now the states own and control their mineral deposits, and they share some benefits with the national companies. I will switch now to one of the papers that I wrote when I was at Columbia. It was the geopolitics of oil and gas. It was to show a case where China and Russia, how they differently used the oil and gas power that they have in a soft form. Well, it was now proven that Russia can use it in a harder form, not just soft. And I will, just by reading, you will understand, or listening, you will understand how I arrived to that result. So this paper examines how China and Russia independently use their substantial influence in global geopolitical events, which is soft power, via means of their economic stature and oil and gas holdings, respectively. The main difference, of course, is that China is a net importer of hydrocarbons, where Russia is a net exporter. So energy is the state's ability to provide the framework for economic development and prosperity, and thus economy is one of their four basic sovereign power projections. In the parlance of diplomacy, they call it DIME. D for diplomacy, I for information, M for military, and E for economic. Economy, in turn, empowers and strengthens the other aspects of the state to strengthen defense, diplomacy, and information. Economy then becomes a soft power, and anything that helps the economy is used under the soft power, but nevertheless could range from passive to aggressive. Both Russia and China have displayed a range of policies relating to the security of demand. That is, if you're asking for my product, I have security of demand, in the case of Russia, and energy security for China to critically continue to develop its growing economy. The importer and export example were purposely chosen so that to prove that the leverage of the soft power of the fossil fuels can cut both ways to the producer, exporter, and user, importer. Both examples are extremes for each case, where Russia is among the top three global exporters of hydrocarbons, and China is the second largest importer. These are unique situations. There are other exporters who do not yield as much sovereign power, and definitely there are importers who are simply price takers. Russia has used its position as a pivotal exporter of gas to Europe to extract political and economic advantages. Furthermore, it used the supply interruption threat to force price adjustments and political manipulation. It's still doing it. Russia is the epitome of weaponizing the soft power of energy supply to convert to hard politics and dime power projection. On the other hand, China used its economic standing first to weaponize its investment ability to secure overseas sources of upstream oil and gas infrastructure and secure its supply, and in particular, the over-the-land delivery of raw material. So soft power is among the available options to a sovereign state to project its policies to an anarchic and multilateral world order. In addition, DIME, diplomatic information, military, economic, the U.S.'s particular and now select regional and up-and-coming powers have added financial intelligence and legal powers to it. So the economic power can be in the form of trading and cooperation, development and technology, with the financial means to sanction and restrictions on the economic front, or inclusion in the SWIFT transactions and banking system. So one of the latest sanctions that we have done with Russia is that we put a cap on the price of oil that they can sell, not in the amount, but the price, so that they have enough supply in the marketplace so that the price doesn't go up, but it's not too cheap, so they don't make any money and stop the supply altogether. So that is a brilliant idea. Good for the current administration to come up with that. That it balances this supply and demand. A weak state with hydrocarbon reserves makes for a valuable target. So strong exporting states gain so much combined power that present a security dilemma to the rest of the anarchic world on the order. On the other hand, the consumers of these strategic resources, who may be major economic powers, invest strategically in securing supplies or against disruptions and shocks that may adversely affect their economies and act to preempt or prevent conflicts that may cause growth disruptions. So energy security is a concept developed in the eve of World War I when the British, then the most powerful maritime global power, switched from coal to oil to fuel its ships, much like kerosene had replaced whale oil. It was soon realized that sources and their diversity is the key to security. So the strategic importance of oil had entered in the state's vocabulary. Russia discovered large deposits of hydrocarbons in Siberia in the 60s, and since has been a net exporter following the breakup of USSR in 92 and after the dust settled about the ownership of the national oil companies and the oligarchs. Russia became an energy exporter powerhouse. It has about 6% of the world's proven oil reserves, estimated at about 79 billion, 45% of non-OPEC reserves, about 45%. The state, via its national company, is in control of its oil wealth. The management of Gazprom, for example, their biggest oil company, and Rosneft, the state-owned oil company, is staffed with political leadership answering to Kremlin and specifically to Putin. The corruption is pervasive, and the state has gone against the oligarchs that don't adhere to the party line and lost their ownership in addition to imprisonment. So during the 2000s and the peak of oil pricing, Russia played an outsized role in geopolitical affairs by exporting nearly $350 billion worth of raw refined hydrocarbon products. Particularly in 2008, oil and gas exports accounted for two-thirds of Russian exports and one-third of the general government revenue. That's huge. In contrast, in 2017, mineral oils, fuels, and distillate products accounted for 48% of the exports at about $173 billion. A dramatic drop based on the market price, while the production remained fairly steady, staying on top of three producers of oil, USA and Saudi Arabia, and gas, US and Qatar. In 2004, Russia set up two rainy day funds from the oil and gas windfall, which in 2008 were valued at about $225 billion. The funds were primarily used to finance a 10-year military recovery and build-up plan following the disastrous breakup of the Soviet Union, which, according to Putin, is among the most important geopolitical events of the 20th century. In Putin's and, by extension, the Russian psyche, a rich Russia must be military powerful to discourage invaders and regain its lost luster of the empire of the 100 years ago. So the remaining funds were used to fuel their economy and to recover from the global financial crisis. I will then start to talk about something else I want to mention about Russia. It may be coincidental that the Georgian war in 2008 was a month after the price of oil had peaked at the highest price since 1980. So Putin felt empowered without power, felt untouchable, and he could afford to take risks. The prospects of NATO enlargement was unbearable to him. So when NATO expanded in 2008, Russia was not ready to protect its power. It was ready to protect its power with the coffers really full of petrodollars. We will now talk about the Chinese economy. The Chinese economy accounts for almost somewhere between 15 and 20% of global GDP, 13% of global trade, and 30% of global oil demand growth. We heard about the 6.5% GDP growth, but that's not untenable any longer. China is in transition from a state-run to a partially market-guided economy and from an export-oriented growth to a consumer-driven economy, causing oil demand to slow from the current 2 to 3% of China importer. It's import 65% of its demand from around the world. So geostrategically, the Strait of Malacca becomes a choke point should anyone, including the United States, decides to stop the flow of oil to China. So China has one pipeline from Russia, and the rest of it is seafaring ships that bring the oil to their shores. So as China rises in the industrialized world order, it recognizes that it needs more foreign expertise, private enterprises and capital. But since China is still in the transition and the Communist Party is in control of major levels of the bureaucracy, the market will continue to perceive the volatility of the interim economic state. So the latest five-year plan from the party, the Communist Party, the 13th five-year plan, indicates a shift of importance from energy security to environmental improvement. In the 12th year five-year plan, the 12th five-year plan, the main priority was to secure ample supply from diverse sources while performing, while preferring to process the crude domestically. The 13th five-year plan, the Chinese that is, includes a pledge to cap energy consumption to about 5 billion tons of standard coal equivalent by 2020 measures, and to increase non-fossil fuel to 50% from 11% or so from 2015 numbers. Diesel and coal demand are about one-third of the total demand, but this lighter distillates may have been in demand for the rise of their auto sales, which now they're converting to electrical EVs. Additionally, the shift to consumer economy has increased the demand for petrochemicals, for packaging and plastics. From the mid-2000s to 2015, China imports increased 2.5 million barrels to 6.5 million barrels. That is a huge amount, causing concern in the Communist Party leadership about the associated vulnerabilities of import dependence and especially U.S. military capabilities. So inside of the weakness and supporting its national oil companies, China instituted a policy to invest in upstream outside the country, upstream meaning find its own sources, in addition to offering loans and credit to producing countries in return for the oil. They gave them infrastructure and equity, cash. The beneficiaries of those are countries like Angola, Kazakhstan, Russia, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Oman, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia. Upstream investments and loans account for just under half of the oil imports. The 2014 oil price collapse highlighted the fundamental flaws in the oil security policy that they had, due to its reliance on fragile or problematic states. A lot of the states that they loaned to, they couldn't pay them back. So they were giving them oil instead of cash. The most significant success, though, was the oil-backed $25 billion loan to Russia to build a pipeline that gave them security and stability over land. So contrary to the Russian aggressive foreign policy of using the oil and gas export levels against its clients and the rest of the world, China is using its economic power and energy demand as a tool of foreign policy. Recently, the effort is made not only to secure diversified and secure sources of oil and gas, but now to buy at the best possible economic terms, including not only the direct purchase of oil, but the ownership of the process and the means, as well as the financing of the infrastructure and the upstream process. This is a more holistic approach to securing energy than purely purchasing it. It was jokingly said that the Chinese are not buying in Brazil, They rather are buying Brazil because Brazil was a source of oil to them. The country can be substituted for other Asian or Latin American countries. The One Belt, One Road project, a brilliant example. I think that's a brilliant example of the Communist Party's power projection. It's a soft foreign policy to secure energy and to export technology, financing, and expertise, in addition to manpower. The Chinese, because of the one-child policy, they overproduced males, and they're either going to use them in the policing state, in the army, or export them as construction workers around the world. And they did all of that, all of those three. So the One Belt, One Road extends land and sea routes from China towards sources and targets of the goods and services that China needs to maintain its growth and therefore the Communist Party longevity. It also coupled with the rest of the dime IFL powers that I mentioned before, projects the rising power of China. The PLA, the People's Liberation Army, the military, has been building a blue water fleet to reach out from its shores to secure the supplies of mostly raw materials and energy so not to be interrupted and sustain the economic growth. Think about the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy is our projection of power and the protector of the trading routes. The Chinese are in the process. It will take them a long time to do that, but in the process of trying to achieve that. So the two powers that I mentioned are interested in their powers and how they project them. But I will switch now to a U.S.-based thought that I wrote a small piece when I was applying to become a White House fellow, which unfortunately did not succeed, but I made inroads out of 7,500 applicants that were originally selected throughout the United States. They were qualified to be selected. I made it three rounds of interviews, but I was not successful. It would have been a great thing being in the White House, watching the happenings around the world from the source of power. So one of my tasks was to write a memorandum to POTUS. POTUS stands for President of the United States. So it had to be something that was dramatic, that the chief of staff of the president, when he read it, he would have been wowed by it and said, wow, I need to get this guy right next to me to advise me on things. So I thought of not crazy things. I thought for something that can make a sense. So back then, the president was Trump. So I was addressing Mr. President. I said, Mr. President, as President Kennedy had challenged us to go out to the moon, and we did, you can claim to have achieved truly energy independence and security through quantum computing and fusion nuclear energy as the leading source of our technological achievements and human progress in the 21st century. Recently, we have attained energy security, and we're essentially close to reaching energy independence. We achieve this precarious Goldilocks conditions by matching our sources and uses, surprisingly, without a comprehensive federal energy policy, and arguably by primarily developing our own fossil fuels with technology and entrepreneurship. Our fossil fuel reserves, as the mainstay of our energy security, should be diminishing as other sources pose much less risk to our environment. The stability of the international energy market affects the U.S. directly and vice versa. Thus, independence is relevant to the condition of the hydrocarbon supply and demand globally. Our economic output has evolved under continuous influence of supply disruptions or price swings, and we became resilient by developing the economic, political, technological, and military clout to protect our achievements to assure our continuous and uninterrupted economic development. We should be first to develop and commercialize quantum computing. Bob, to your point before, quantum computing will help us to expand the fusion nuclear energy sector as our primary source of electricity generation, to triple the current share of 19% of electricity generated from clean nuclear sources. Utilizing quantum computing to perfect fusion, which is the combination of subatomic particles, where fission is the breakup of subatomic particles. For the generation of energy, should our primary policy, that should be it. Let's increase that percent with clean fusion nuclear energy. It takes titanic computational ability to control the nuclear chain reactions happening under tremendous pressures and temperatures and harness this unimaginable energy release from the nuclei. Fusion starts with material found in nature, like deuterium, and the byproduct of the reaction is helium, an inert gas, harmless, and water. The security of the nuclear plants have been proven unambiguously in civilian uses. While let's remember that the U.S. Navy has been using fission reactors for nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and submarines without any incident for the last 60 years. By promoting the electrification in the entire transportation sector beyond the private all-electric cars to include heavy-duty and commercial vehicles, the excess oil will be exported because we're not going away from the hydrocarbon-based economies in the foreseeable future. As I said, my projection is 25 to 30 years. Additionally, diverting the use of natural gas from electricity generation, to primarily heating, transportation, and industrial purposes should further expand LNG exports, therefore strengthen our economy and give us the leverage for other countries. By using more of the cleaner fusion energy, we are becoming truly energy independent and secure while freeing the oil and gas for exports to further influence the world's energy markets. Additionally, since the industrial sector uses substantial amounts of hydrocarbons, the U.S. should attract the global petrochemical industry, huge, to continue setting up the industrial factories in the U.S., close to our abundant supplies of raw material. Finally, the U.S. should continue to support the fiscal policies, the development and use of renewable energy sources for residential and commercial uses. Mr. President, your legacy will be indelible in the annals of world history as the American president who gave us our energy independence and national security. For the fossil fuels, maintain our technological supremacy and sealed Pax Americana for the rest of the 21st century. Well, thank you for listening to me today. I know it was a lot of material. We covered a lot of information, and there's still more to come, and we will have another version of this energy geopolitics in the foreseeable future. Have a great weekend.
This is your community radio station serving lower Fairfield County and Westchester. 1490 WGCH in Greenwich.
USA News, I'm Jeremy Scott. One of the largest shipments of weapons yet to Ukraine is on its way. The $2.5 billion package includes air defense systems, artillery, and combat vehicles, but not the tanks that Ukraine requested. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says it will help meet Ukraine's needs on the battlefield as Russia continues its nearly year-long invasion. The White House announces new sanctions against a Russian-affiliated mercenary group. Here's Jared Rizzi.
The White House wants to make it harder for companies and countries to do business with Wagner Group, a big part of Russia's military machine. Here's National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
Our message to any company that is considering providing support to Wagner is simply this. Wagner is a criminal organization that is committing widespread atrocities and human rights abuses.
Kirby says Wagner has so far deployed 50,000 private military personnel to Ukraine.
A newly unsealed search warrant might point to the motive of Brian Koberger, who's accused of murdering four Idaho college students. The warrant reveals several items seized from his home following his arrest included hair strands. He's facing four counts of first-degree murder in the killings of Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Ethan Chapin, and Zana Kernodal. He's due back in court in June. Graceland is hosting a public memorial service this weekend for Lisa Marie Presley. She'll be buried at the site's meditation garden near her son, Elvis, and his parents. Fans will be able to view the gravesite following the memorial service on Sunday. Presley died last week at the age of 54. The Kansas City Chiefs looking to advance to their fifth consecutive AFC championship when they host the Jacksonville Jaguars this afternoon. The New York Giants visit the NFC's top seed Philadelphia Eagles tonight. Sunday marks the return match between Cincinnati and Buffalo, the first since DeMar Hamlin had a heart attack on the field. This is USA News.
So right now may be the perfect time for you to rethink how you pay for healthcare, and here's why. Not only is it open enrollment for a lot of people, it's also a time you can join MediShare and save even more than usual. And it's true, the typical family switching to MediShare saves $500 or more a month, which is obviously huge for a lot of people, but what's more, they like it. MediShare has double the customer satisfaction rate compared to health insurance. Double. There are 400,000 members, they've shared over $4 billion in medical bills, and it really is a great community, too. People encourage and pray for each other. And here's the thing. If you join MediShare Complete right now, they'll waive your new member fees and you'll save an additional 10% off all of 2023. That's right. No fee to join. 10% off every month of next year. But it's a very limited time offer. You have to sign up before January 15th. Great savings. Great health care. Find out more. Call now. 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
An Illinois judge grants a temporary restraining order keeping a new gun control law from being enforced. About 800 lawsuits against the state's new ban on, quote, assault weapons were filed in state and federal courts. The law puts a limit on the sale of high-capacity ammunition magazines and bans devices that allow semi-automatic weapons to fire rounds automatically. Those opposing the measure say it violates their Second Amendment rights. Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker remains confident the law will be upheld. A handful of Colorado police officers and paramedics are pleading not guilty in the killing of Elijah McClain.
McClain, a black man, died while in police custody a little over 3 years ago after he was placed in a chokehold and given ketamine while handcuffed. Police officer Randy Rodema and former officer Jason Rosenblatt will be tried separately for their role in restraining McClain, while paramedics Jeremy Cooper and Peter Chikuniek will also face a separate trial for injecting McClain with ketamine. Medical experts have said the ketamine injection led to McClain's death. I'm Ryan Daniels.
Existing home sales across the USA are at a 12-year low. The National Association of Realtors said that sales of previously owned homes fell 1.5% last month and were down for the 11th straight month. High mortgage rates and tight supply kept many buyers